Welcome to ACC's CardiaCast. I'm Dr. Ty Gluckman, Medical Director of the Center for Cardiovascular Analytics, Research, and Data Science at the Providence Heart Institute in Portland, Oregon. And today I'm interviewing Dr. Rashmi Shah on how cardiovascular clinicians can leverage the power of real-world data and real-world evidence to improve care. This is the first episode in a series of three recorded at the New York Cardiovascular Symposium in December of 2019. This episode was made possible with support from Janssen Pharmaceuticals. Rashmi, it's a pleasure to have you here today. Could you please introduce yourself for our listeners?
Thank you, Dr. Gluckman. So, as you said, my name's Rashmi Shah. I'm a non-invasive cardiologist at the University of Utah in the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine. I've been there for about 5 years, and my clinical practice focuses on inpatient cardiac care and echocardiography, and my research focus is related to real-world data and electronic health records to access real-world data for patients.
Fantastic. It's a great introduction, and we just heard you give a phenomenal presentation at the meeting focused on real-world data, talking about advantages and disadvantages. Can you give me a little bit of background or overview about what you talked about at the meeting?
Yeah, so if you think traditionally about how we acquire and use evidence in cardiology, it's been generally focused on randomized control trials. That's the gold standard for developing evidence for our treatments that we're going to provide to the patients. But more and more, we're shifting some focus towards what's called real-world evidence. Now, the motivation behind that is that clinical trials tend to be small numbers of patients. They take a long time and a lot of money to execute, and they are not necessarily generalizable to the patients we're actually seeing in practice. So, for example, a clinical trial might include heart attack patients with an average age of 50, whereas the patients we're actually seeing in practice have an average age of 70, let's say. So the idea behind real-world evidence is we can get at some of these inefficiencies and limitations of randomized clinical trials. Now, in order to do this, we need real-world data. There are many possible sources for real-world data. It could range from wearables, genetic data, but at the moment, the predominant source of data is from the electronic medical record. So the electronic medical record is capturing data as part of routine clinical care, and lots of data, and that amount of data is continuing to increase. And we can, if we can develop methods to successfully use that data, we can implement it then in new ways to generate evidence to find the right treatments for the right patients.
That's really, really helpful. You use a term in your presentation referred to as curated real-world data. And I guess for the listeners, trying to understand what that means, and is all of the data that's in the electronic medical record something that's available to be used? And what are the limitations of the data that we get out of the electronic medical record and how we may potentially overcome that?
Yeah. So data is messy. Doesn't matter what field you're in, healthcare, outside of healthcare, data is just messy. And I would say that's particularly true for healthcare data for a couple of reasons. Generally, you can think of data from the electronic medical record in two categories, structured and unstructured data. Structured data is the sort of stuff that's captured the same way, the same format for every patient every time. That's the stuff that is queryable. Many healthcare systems now have big databases that are searchable, and structured data allows you to quickly search and find large numbers of patients. The drawback there is the structured data is not granular. So an example of structured data is a ICD-9 or 10 billing code. That says, you know, the code I48.0 is paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. But that doesn't really say much beyond that condition about the patient. So some patients with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation are young and run marathons and are at high altitudes. That's one type. Some patients are 85 years old, incredibly frail, and live in a nursing home. Those structured data elements don't capture those phenotypes about the patients, which really are critical for understanding the effect of different treatments for different patient groups. So that's a big limitation of real-world data, structured data anyway. The other side of this is unstructured data. So the most common example of unstructured data is the clinical notes. So if you're a clinician and you're seeing patients in the real world, when you want to know something about the patient, what do? You read the notes. You're not looking at a list of billing codes. But the notes say phrases like patient is weak, patient is frail. And the challenge is how do you extract that data from the electronic medical record in a way that's usable for big data analyses? And a lot of people are working on something called natural language processing, which is computer algorithms to extract the text and classify it into, turn this unstructured data essentially into structured data that's usable by computers. So generally, you know, there's these two categories of data in the electronic medical record. Structured data is easy to use, but it's not granular. It's incomplete. Unstructured data is harder to use, but there's a lot of efforts in making pipelines to use that sort of unstructured data.
And you talked about natural language processing being applied to notes, but I presume natural language processing could be applied to an ECG interpretation, mm-hmm. an echocardiogram. Where are you beginning to see natural language processing used in your own institution, and is it more of a research tool, or is it being used clinically to drive decisions in practice?
Yeah, so the answer is both clinically and in research. On the research side, the one I'm seeing most is for quote-unquote phenotyping and to actually find genetic genotype-phenotype association. So if you look at very typical phenotype, like let's say Down syndrome, you know, that people describe the faces and the appearance of those patients, and that's a phenotype. You can find it with natural language processing and then do a genotype-phenotype association study. That's on the research end. On the clinical practice end, I'm actually seeing it used not for trying to generate evidence. It's used in a limited way to assess quality. So, for example, our institution is looking for patients with DVTs or PEs and looking at their treatment. And they're using NLP to find those patients with DVTs and PEs. It's broadly being used for billing. So a lot of these companies use NLP to find diagnosis to bill for inpatient stays. So that's generally how I see it being used. But I think the use is definitely going to expand. A lot of companies are interested in this field. Amazon is a big example. They have a whole suite of tools to allow people to do this basically from their computer anywhere.
Wow. And, you know, you think about health systems that have thought that the keys to the kingdom is through structured data. And so they've created templates, forms, fields where clinicians, cardiovascular team members can enter data. Our registries are somewhat based off of that because we're abstracting and entering into other areas. Do you think the future direction is trying to figure out ways and workflows to support easier entry of structured data, or has NLP not come into its own, and that really is the future, letting people do work as usual, document as they will, and allow the computer in the back end to really pull data out and essentially sort it into the right areas on the back end?
Oh, that's a great question. So when I started in this area, I actually thought we should force more things into structured fields. So a good example of that is the VA CART database. It's the data collection system for the VA cath lab. And it requires people to enter parameters into structured fields, like which stent did you use, and then it generates a report. So it forces structured entry. On the other side, I've sort of come around to this new way of thinking that the way data collection is designed needs not to be for the researchers or for the billing people. It needs to be for the clinicians and the patients. And forcing clinicians to click boxes enter structured field is clearly not working. Everybody dislikes the electronic medical record very much. So as I see advancements here, I think it is possible that we could move back to a system of dictation, and that's better for the clinical workflow, and the NLP software is going to become good enough to take that dictation, understand what it's saying, and put it mostly into structured data fields. Google actually has a product here already, but none of this, I think, is ready for widespread release in prime time, but I think that's probably the better direction to go. Make the tools for the clinicians and the patients, and let the researchers and the billing people and the administrative people adapt to what the clinicians and patients need.
One of your particular interests has been in the atrial fibrillation space, mm-hmm. leveraging NLP to help guide stroke and systemic embolism risk assessment. Mm-hmm. And we have payers and quality personnel and organizations who are saying, how many people do you have with a CHA2DS2 VASC across above a certain threshold that would warrant anticoagulant therapy, and where are gaps in care? Where are you seeing this applied overall? How do you see this sort of coming to the fore, not just for somebody to query this 2 months from now, 2 weeks from now, or 2 days from now to say you have X number of patients and they're not receiving optimal therapy, but are we at a point where we can begin to see NLP real time that can query information and say, hey, the clinician that's managing the patient at that moment, you have a patient sitting in front of you, we've looked at some data scouring the chart, and it turns out their CHA2DS2 VAS score is 4, and they're appropriate for this therapy. Is that too far out there in the future, or are we going to likely see that in the next few years?
The answer, it's not too far out in the future. I think it's now. In our institution, we have two mechanisms for that purpose. It's not NLP-driven, though. One is each patient has a lifetime of data on the electronic medical record, and there's an algorithm in our EPIC system that looks at those diagnoses and suggests what the CHA2DS2 VAS score should be. My observation is that us in cardiology, we're not using that. The house staff, they are using it. The pharmacists who run our anticoagulation service, they are using it, but they're always checking. They're not sure they believe it. People are definitely using it. I think over time it will get better and better as the data quality that's leading up to that classification gets better and better. That's one system we have. The other one is using something called a FHIR app. So FHIR is a data standard to allow data exchange. So the electronic medical records have some format by which they collect data. Generally, that format has been in such a way that it can only be used by that electronic medical record. But now there's a new way to do it called FHIR, where that electronic medical record can put the data in a different type of format that will allow people to create essentially apps. So this is like analogous to your Android phone. There's an API essentially that lets anybody create an Android phone app. It's just like that. And so we have a kind of collaborative partnership with MD Calc. And they have generated a FHIR app to calculate the CHA2DS2 VAS score from the EPIC EMR. And we've done some analysis of that and actually found, just like the one based on historical billing codes, it generally overestimates the CHA2DS2 VAS score compared to what the clinician thinks the CHA2DS2 VAS score is. So now I'm very careful to say, I don't know which one's right. I don't know if that automated score is right or if the clinician's right. I don't know. But the real test here is if we implement this in a strategic, broad sort of way, can we demonstrate either decreased strokes or decreased bleeding events? And that's really the measure by which we're going to say this type of approach is better than the current approach, which is sort of ad hoc. And I think in terms of these sorts of approaches, we really have not hit that bar yet where we're showing it truly helps some patient-centered outcome.
This has been amazing to listen to, and I know for our listeners as well. So in summary, just to go back, we're always going to have some structured data that's going to exist and inform real-world evidence going forward, but I think you brought to light the notion that a lot of our unstructured data can be curated in a fashion with technology that's available even today, even if it's not being implemented at your local institution, but that can bring the data that's out there into a more curated, structured format that can improve patient care and inform research for years to come.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think a really key part of this is that the clinicians have to get really involved in this. The error I think we might have made with the electronic medical records is that the clinicians were not the people in charge of developing that. So now we're entering another phase of basically electronic medical record optimization. And the clinicians really need to get in on this and say what we need and, you know, in line with what the patients need.
Great. I want to thank Dr. Rashmi Shah for speaking with us today. It's been a real pleasure. And I know you've enlightened our listeners significantly. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.